we are going to be in Matthew 27. We're getting near the end. It's been a journey, but we're into the last few weeks in the Gospel of Matthew. And in some ways, Matthew chapter 27 kind of is the low moment. You know the songs that often, and I promise I'm not going to ruin another song for us. I've done this way too many times. But there's a whole series of songs that kind of, they sort of like, they tell the life of Jesus, if you know what I mean. They kind of talk through, like, here's his life, and he comes as a baby, and then he does certain things, and then usually the music, I don't know, I'm not particularly musical, but even I can kind of track with it. It's like, there's sort of like an upbeat tempo. It's like, yes, he came. And then there's sort of this low moment, and it gets quieter usually when we get to the cross, and he suffers, and he dies, and it's sort of that somber. And then he rises, and he conquers. But in the middle of the song, there's this, that's Matthew 27. This is the moment. In fact, when I open my Bible, and the headings aren't scripture, but they're just sort of helpful little tools of like, what's going on? It's like, Jesus is mocked. Jesus is beaten. Jesus is crucified. The death of Jesus, the burial of Jesus. Like these aren't things where you look and it's like, yes, we understand there is a right sense of reverence, a little bit sense of how solemn this is as we consider that Jesus went to the cross because I am a guilty sinner. And aside from that, there is no hope. That's one aspect of Matthew 27, but I want to show you another layer of it without completely losing that piece. And somehow I think in our minds we need to hold all these pieces, and I think that's how Scripture intends them to be held, because there's another angle to this story where you come to Matthew chapter 27, and Matthew's going to tell us the account of the death of Jesus on the cross through a set of lenses that are going to help us understand that even in his mockery, even in the injustice of a trial, even in his crucifixion on a cross, even in his death, he is triumphant. He's not weak. Now, the four Gospels all give us the life of Jesus, right? And so they all tell the stories, not in conflict, but just sort of pointing out different things. Matthew's going to do something a little different than the other four Gospels. He's going to give us the account of the death of Christ with two important sets of lenses. And I want us to understand them before we look at this chapter. I badly ran out of time in first service, so we have to do this really quick. I started with an analogy to help you kind of understand how I look at this. I've got three grandkids, one who is very much talking, one who is trying, and one who will be shortly, I am soon, assured, even though he's only a few months old, because my grandkids are so advanced. Before we had our grandkids, you know, people said things like, it's like, you're going to love this. Like, having grandkids is awesome. Or like, I don't know, I wasn't awesome at little kids. As our kids grew, I kind of came into my own, but like little kids, I'm like, sort of surprising. It's like, they're not saying anything. They're like drool and their stuff, but, and then the grandkids came along. It is awesome. It is all the fun, and maybe even a bit more, minus the sleep deprivation. Be praying for our young families. This is tough sledding. I have yet to change a dirty diaper for any of my grandkids. It's like, this is brilliant. And like they go away, you know, get all cleaned up, and there's grandpa on the floor with all the toys. It's like, this is brilliant. I'm loving it. There is just one slight drawback. Here's the drawback. When you are immersed with little kids, and you're just spending so much time, you can understand the things they're saying. I don't know if you've ever experienced this. Like parents who are with their little kids and the little kids start speaking, they're like, oh, yes, oh, you want that? And you're like listening and like, I could sense their words, but my ears are not picking up. But after a while, your ears start to get trained to it. So you play with a little like a three-year-old or two-year-old, and like after a while, you're like, oh, I can understand what you're saying. I don't know, maybe this is just me. If this doesn't make any sense, I apologize. But there's another layer to this as well. That's when you play things, particularly Plato, because they are making things. And they are apparently real things. And because I'm not quite as immersed in it as, say, my wife, who's often with our grandkids and gets to be a little bit more involved, she's like looking and she's like, "Oh, Adelie, are you making a turtle?" She's like, "Yes, Grandma." And I'm looking, I'm like, I didn't see it. Now, I've learned some things. I've learned to first make sure that Linda tells me what's going on. "Hey, Don, that's a goat." "Oh, wow, look at the goat, the Play-Doh goat. Of course it's a goat. We could all see that it was a goat or a turtle, right?" And I need sort of the interpreter who's kind of a little bit more used to the language and kind of what's going on to be able to help me. That's the one drawback of being a grandpa. You're not in there enough. Now, I say all that because what I want to try to do this morning is kind of have, I want to play that role for you when it comes to how Matthew's going to tell the story of Matthew chapter 27. There are some things that are going on just kind of behind the scenes. Once you see them, you're going to go, "Oh, of course, it's a turtle. I get it. I see what Matthew's doing." We just don't necessarily always think it because we're not immersed in the world he's immersed in. So two things that we need to understand. Number one, Matthew's going to tell the story of the death of Jesus on the cross through the lens of Psalm 22. Now, some of you may have heard some of this before, so it's just a refresher course. This is really important. Psalm 22 is a psalm of David. You can go read it sometime. It's got an introductory verse, verse 1, my God, why have you forsaken me?" That's that verse 1 statement. The forsaken in it is a perfect verb. This actually does matter because it means I have been forsaken and I will forevermore be forsaken. It's a pretty jarring word. It's like a perfect verb means a completed action. It's done. It's over. I've been forsaken with ongoing effects. So it's like David's like looking through the lens of life. He's like, "I have been forsaken. I will forevermore be forsaken. It is over. All I'm going to experience now is the effects of forsakenness." Now, if you've read through the Psalms, a lot of them have sort of a similar plot line. They start with a hard part of life, the trial of life. Oftentimes, you'll get David writing a psalm that sounds something like this. "Why are the wicked prospering and the righteous are suffering? In this world, I look out and this world makes no sense." And he's like, "And as I look out, I feel like my feet are starting to slip." And some of you have been there. You've gone through hard things. It's like, "Lord, where are you? Where are you in your greatness or goodness? And my faith is starting to slip." And then David circles back and he's like, "And then I remembered the Lord is in his temple. This world is his. The story is not over. And as I remembered all those things, the fact that I was seeing injustice right now, oh, the whole perspective changed." And the psalm ends with praise of God. He moves from despair to praise because he sees things different. Psalm 22 is kind of like that. It starts with, my God, where are you? Why have you forsaken me?" And then the psalm has three pieces. It's a super easy psalm because there's 10 verses in each section. First 10 verses, his anguish. Go read it. You're reading the anguish of a man who is just feeling like life has just completely come unglued. The next 10 verses are a statement about the persecution and the suffering that others are inflicted on him. It's like, "Everywhere I turn, people are against me." And then the last 10 verses are an astounding shift because David remembers some things that he knows to be true about God. It actually starts in verse 19. There's just this hint in verse 19. That although he's told us he's utterly forsaken in verse 1, by 19, he's like, "But you, O Lord, do not be far off. You are my help. Come quickly to my aid." Like, he's told us, like, "I'm forsaken and it's over." But by verse 19, he's like, "But God, would you come to my aid?" And he continues to work through this by verse 22. "I'll tell of your name to my brothers in the midst of the congregation. I'll praise you, you who fear the Lord. Praise him." Like, David, how did you get to praise when you told us in verse 1 God had completely and utterly forsaken you? And he continues to move through this. Verse 24, "For he has not despised or abhorred the affliction of the affliction, and he has not hidden his face from him, but he has heard his cry." That's very different than verse 1. Verse 1 is, "I am completely and utterly alone." Verse 24, "No, I'm not. No, I'm not. And he hears my cry." By the end of Psalm 22, and this is not a sermon on Psalm 22, so I gotta just move real quick. By the end of Psalm 22, it's like, and then all the nations are gonna worship him. Because one day we're all gonna see this, and there's this incredible movement through Psalm 22 from complete and utter despair, hopelessness, brokenness, anguish to worship of God because I remembered who he is. Okay, that's important. That's the first piece. Just kind of hold that for a minute because there's one other piece that we need before we jump into Matthew 27. The Jewish people, and they picked up on language from the Old Testament. If you ever read Old Testament Psalms, you will see this. You will not be able to miss it. They talked about that day. It's a weird language. Like, and you're like, which day? It's like, oh, they all knew which day. That day was the day when God was going to step into history and he was going to right everything that was wrong. Like they saw evil, they saw injustice, they saw sin. But on that day, oh, everything's going to change. Now, associated with that day, that specific little phrase, comes three ideas in first century Judaism. Number one, on that day, God will deal with evil. It'll be dealt with. Number two, on that day, it will be like there is a new creation. The old order of things will be set aside, and there will be something so majestic and so amazing. The prophets speak with new creation language. Go read the end of Isaiah. It's how he speaks. You get to the end of the book of Isaiah, and you're like, it feels like Genesis 1 all over again, because this teaching, this expectation that on that day, wow, evil's gone, new creation. And there is a third feature on that day. There will be a resurrection. Death will be defeated and life will triumph. Now, you can go read, and if you want to read some of this stuff, Ezekiel 37, I already mentioned Isaiah 65, Zechariah 14, Amos chapter 8. I only mention them because I will not have time to kind of reference them as we work through this. But those three features are really, really important. So, evil done, new creation, resurrection. Okay, now we're ready to read Matthew chapter 27. Okay, Emily already read most of it for us, beginning in verse 27, where she helped us see the beginning point of this scene. And there's like bookends to the scene in verse 27. And then if you jump ahead to verse 54, you're going to see how Matthew's putting together the account of the death of Jesus. At the beginning, we have a scene where the Roman soldiers are going to mock Jesus. And there's the structure of it is the focus is on this statement of, "Hail, Jesus, King of the Jews." I don't have time to walk through that whole thing because time goes fast. But you can trust me on this, that the point of verse 27 to 31 is this mockery of Jesus as the king. In fact, the whole scene is a giant mockery of him. There's a battalion gathered. They're gathered in the private praetorium, so now the Jewish people wouldn't have been there. That's what verse 27 is about. They've taken Jesus. The trials happen. They gather him together. They bring a whole battalion of Roman soldiers. That's 600 soldiers. You got to picture this in your mind's eye. There's Jesus, one man, who's already been beaten and flogged. He's been put through horrific things, now paraded in front of 600 soldiers, and they are going to do a mock coronation. That's what's going on in these verses. They put a robe on. It's a scarlet, purplish robe. That's the robe you'd put on a king as he's coming to his throne. Then they put a crown on his head. And we often think of crowns as the sign of authority. That's not the Roman lens. A crown in the Roman lens is the sign of victory. So if a king won a victory, they would put a crown on his head. If you won multiple victories, they would put multiple crowns on you. Remember, growing up, we used to sing this song, you know, and crown him, Lord. Crown him, crown him. It's about victory. I'm not going to, I should stop. I know. Some of you are like, please stop. It's enough. We get it. So when you get to Revelation, if you don't know that, you won't understand what Revelation is saying. By chapter 19 of Revelation, it's like they crown him with multiple crowns or diadems. They're like, there's many crowns on his head. And I remember like trying to picture that as a kid. It's like, did they stack them? Did they hang them? For those of us who are a little bit literal, trying to figure. The point is, he has won every victory. That's the picture of crowns. So the Roman soldiers, as they beat him, and are about to kill him, go, you know what would be really funny? We'll put a crown on his head. Because if you think he won anything, this is going to be good. We'll make sure the whole world knows what a farce he is. Scarlet robe, king, crown, victory. Then they put a reed in his hand. It's like, here's like a pretend scepter. Scepter is the authority piece in the Roman land. You get a scepter in your hand, you're the guy in charge. They put it in his hand. Then what do? Take it back out and hit him. It's a mock coronation. They are going to make fun of Jesus. You see the irony in the scene? He actually is the king. He's not just any king, he is the king of kings. And they will laugh at this whole thing. You jump forward to the end of the story, and who is it that makes this incredible statement? And I would argue that the statement they make in verse 54 is like the statement they make way back in 29, "Hail, King of the Jews," like on steroids, because to say he is the Son of God is infinitely more potent than he's the king in the Roman lens. Like there is one Son of God, and that is actually Caesar. That's the title he took. Tiberius, the Caesar at this time, that was his title. If you are a Roman centurion and you are now saying, truly, that is the Son of God, it's like, probably what happened next is you probably die. But they say it. Between these two moments, Matthew says, I want you to understand why that shift would happen, why you would go from a bunch of Roman soldiers who are going to mock him as king to some Roman centurions who are going to say, truly, this is the Son of God. As you read through the verses that come between that, from verse 32 to 53, Matthew's going to point out some details that if you read through the other Gospels, Mark, Luke, John, they are going to point out different things. John never tells us there's a man named Simon who helps Jesus with his cross. John does tell us lots of the things Jesus says on the cross. If you've been around church for a while, been through sort of the Good Friday, Easter sort of season, sometimes we'll, you know, kind of build a service around the seven sayings of Jesus on the cross. But then you look at Matthew and you're looking for the red letters and you're like, why wouldn't Matthew be concerned to tell us so many of the amazing things that Jesus says from the cross? Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. Or, behold, Mary, this is your son. Like, some of the profound things. It is finished. It's just, none of it's there. Instead, we get this weird statement. The only time actually we're told in all of Scripture, some words that Jesus actually spoke. He spoke Aramaic. This is our only moment of the whole thing. Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani. And Matthew has to give us the translation there in verse 46. My God, why have you forsaken me? And if you're sitting there and going, hold on a second. Didn't we hear that somewhere before? You are exactly right. You heard it, Psalm 22, verse 1. And as we work our way backwards, we actually see that Matthew, that's the exclamation point on what he's doing in this chapter. Back in verse 32, we're told that they take him out, and there's a man from Cyrene. Simon by name. Matthew is the only one that puts it that way. Simon by name. And it's almost like he's wanting you to ask yourself the question. It's like, well, which Simon? Because there actually was another Simon. His name was Peter. And up to now, he was always at Jesus' right hand. Until chapter 26, when he denied Jesus three times and said, I don't even know the man. And all of a sudden, you get at this moment. It's like Jesus, who had said to his disciples back, you know, a number of chapters ago in Matthew, if you had follow me, you must take up your cross, deny yourself, and follow me. And now, here we have Jesus all on his own, and we find this random stranger who Matthew says, oh, by the way, his name is Simon. How ironic is that? That Jesus is completely abandoned, just like David feels back in Psalm 22. Start to get the feel of this, okay? Let's keep working our way through it. Carries the cross, they go to Golgotha. There's a lot of very important things that we're just skipping over for sake of time. But by verse 35, we get to this moment where they had crucified him. To crucify a man means you have nails through his wrists and through his ankles. You go back to Psalm 22, before crucifixion's even been invented. And what's David saying in verse 16? It's like my body has been pierced. You're like, well, that's interesting. Psalm 22 talks about being pierced. Now we have this moment. And in case you think, well, you're reading into that way too much, look at the next thing they did. Look at the next thing Matthew points out that they did. They divided his garments among them, casting lots. It's like, why does that matter? Does that help you understand anything of the gospel? No. It's a completely irrelevant detail. If you had never heard that, would you be confused of like, what's going on the cross? No. It's peripheral. It's off to the side. Jesus is in the cross. He's been crucified. You notice the only thing Matthew actually says about it is right there in verse 35. And when they had crucified him, then Matthew's like, I want you to look over there. Not at Jesus. Look at what's going on over here. They cast lots. They divided his garments. Psalm 22, verse 18. The actual quotation of what they're doing to David in Psalm 22. We keep moving on. They put up this sign. There's, you know, the rebel on the right and the rebel on the left. By verse 39, all those who passed by derided him, wagging their heads. It's like, again, it's like, what does it matter if we know that they passed by wagging their heads? I'm not even sure what it looks like to wag their heads, and I'm not about to attempt to show you what I think it looks like. Matthew's like, I just want you to know that's what they did. When you have time, go back to Psalm 22 and look at verse 7, because it's the exact same phrase that David uses to describe what his enemies are doing to him. They wag their heads. And you just start to get the sense that Matthew's telling you the story of Jesus against the backdrop of Psalm 22. See what he's doing? It's not done yet. It just carries on. A few verses later, they say in verse 43, he trusts in God, let God deliver him. Go read Psalm 22:8. Same thing. It's the same language. Like, how could they have, did they know that? I don't think so. Matthew wants you to see that the things they're saying about Jesus were the things that people were saying about David in this moment, that he is saying, I have been utterly forsaken. Now, there's a whole bunch of other little indicators that we don't have time for. Things like if you look at verse, well, I guess the obvious one, sorry, I just about missed it, 46, is actually Jesus quoting Psalm 22, verse 1. I guess that's the biggie on the eye chart. Like, don't miss that one. That's kind of like, that's sort of like the compass that helps us know that we're actually on the right track. But things like verse 50, Matthew tells us near the end of the story, Jesus cried out again with a loud voice. It's like, okay, Matthew, you're telling us he cried out, but you don't even bother to tell us what he says. Does that not strike you as odd? John is able to tell us what he says. It is finished. Matthew just says he just cries out with a loud voice. Because you go and look at the language of Psalm 22. David is crying out with a loud voice. You go read it. I'm not making this stuff up. If that is the right way to read this, let me just ask you this question. What is Matthew's point in telling you this story against the backdrop of Psalm 22? If it is not to help us understand that as Jesus is going to the cross, as Jesus is being mocked, as Jesus is being crucified, as Jesus is hanging there between two thieves, as Jesus is having the mockery of all these statements against him, it's to read it through those lenses, the lenses of David that says, I've been forsaken. Oh, wait, hold on a second. No, I haven't. No, I have not. God sees me. He hears me. He's going to deliver me. That's the last 10 verses of Psalm 23 or 22. And one day, what does David get to? One day, all the nations of the world are going to see it. And where's Jesus going to get in just a few verses as he comes to his disciples in Matthew chapter 28? Go into all the nations. Like, oh, Matthew, I get it. You've given us like the way to understand what you're trying to tell us. You're trying to tell us that when Jesus is on the cross, I'm not trying to belittle and ignore the fact that he suffers. But don't ignore the fact that he is triumphing. Real quick, and then communion. The last piece, just so you can kind of see how it's going to work itself out. Notice that Matthew moves pretty quickly from Jesus on the cross, spends very little time at any sort of focus on Jesus actually on a cross. It's barely mentioned in the story of his death. What he does want you to start seeing is things like verse 45. Now, from the sixth hour, there was darkness over the land. Like at noon, high noon goes dark. Then he moves down a few verses later, verse 51, and says, now behold. Like, behold is a command to us as the reader. That's actually a command to pay attention to this. And you would expect, it's like we're in the story of Jesus' death on the cross. Surely the thing we're supposed to pay attention to is Jesus. Behold, the curtain of the temple torn in two from top to bottom. The earth shook, rocks were split, the tombs were open, and many bodies of the saints who had fallen asleep were raised. And coming out of the tombs after his resurrection, you see what Matthew has to do to pull these ideas together? He actually has to take an event that is yet to happen. 2 days from this moment, the dead will come out of their tombs after Jesus' resurrection, and they will be raised to life. And Matthew just says, I'm just gathering all that stuff together because I want to have it all in one spot. Because you were living in the first century and you were a Jewish person knowing that one day, the day is coming. He's just giving you the criteria. Judgment of evil, new creation, and what happens next? Resurrection. Those passages I gave you earlier, Ezekiel 34, Zechariah 14, Amos chapter 8, they are all the ones that help you understand. What does it look like when God judges evil? Darkness. What does it look like when there is new creation? Ground shakes, rocks split, because God's going to just shake it all up and make something new. And what's the last thing that has to happen? People get raised from the dead. And Matthew doesn't even answer all the questions that I'm sure you have if you're anything like me. It's like, who was that? How long did they live after this? Where did they go? Like people who had been dead, like we often, I mean, and rightly so, we focus our attention on Jesus rising from the dead, but what Matthew's telling us, like, this is actually, a whole lot of this stuff is happening. And they come back into the city. Like, that seems pretty spectacular. Are these people who've been dead for like hundreds of years? Is it like David and Moses? Is this like someone who just died last week? Told nothing, just resurrection happens. Why? Because this is the glorious day. See what Matthew's point is? Jesus is triumphing, and this is glorious. Theologian from the past said this, in the cross of Christ, as a splendid theater, this is old language, so this is not mockery, this is just 500 years ago language. The incomparable goodness of God is set before the whole world. The glory of God shines indeed in all the creatures, high and below, but never more brightly than in the cross. Isn't that an interesting perspective? The glory of God is never seen more brightly. In Matthew 27. And I know all the songs the temple builds to the resurrection. I'm not saying we should change it. But next time, as you're singing, just know, Jesus is not losing. He's winning.